At age 38, Tremaine Lee turned in the rough draft of his first book. It was about the cost of violence on Black life in America. And that's when the unthinkable happened. A massive heart attack that almost took his life.
But there was another weight on my heart that I had never fully engaged with. As a journalist for, you know, my entire career, operating on the edge of death and survival, Black death and survival in particular, and a family history pocked with early death and violence, I had to engage with that in a way that I had never expected to fully.
Coming up on More to the Story, part one of a very personal conversation about life, death, and navigating journalism as a Black man in America. Stay with us.
What if your perceptions about the past were wrong? Throughline is a podcast that takes you back in time to uncover the parts of the story that may have gone unnoticed.
It effectively turned day into night.
And how it shaped the world now. Time travel with us every week on the Throughline podcast from NPR.
This is More to the Story. I'm Al Letson. Tremaine Lee is a Pulitzer Prize and Emmy Award-winning journalist. He's an MSNBC contributor and hosts the Into America podcast about the intersection of Blackness, power, and politics. And after surviving a massive heart attack, Tremaine began to think deeply about the weight he's been carrying, all the stories he's reported over the years about violence, all the trauma that generations of Black men and his family have endured. That story became his book, A Thousand Ways to Die, The True Cost of Violence on Black Life in America. Tremaine and I have so much to talk about that we're going to split this up into two episodes. And just a heads up, it's going to get pretty personal. Tremaine, man, thank you so much for coming on.
Brother, it's an honor and a pleasure to be here with you, man. So thank you.
Yeah, man. So this is your first book. I should say that, like, as a journalist, like, you've been on this beat for a while. I mean, obviously we know each other. I've been following your work for a minute. So how did it turn into this book?
You know, the earliest seeds of this book were planted when I was just an intern at the Philadelphia Daily News in, like, 2003. I was covering the case of a young brother who was, like, 17, 18 years old, and he got shot in the back of the neck during a robbery. So some other guys tried to rob him for his Allen Iverson jersey. They ended up shooting him, and he ended up being paralyzed. And I found my way into the hospital, and this brother, despite being a quadriplegic, like, he couldn't feel anything from the neck down, was so hopeful and so optimistic. And he told me that he had dreams about walking again. And he's like this hopeful, bright light in the midst of what was clearly like a very dark moment for him and his family. But as he's talking, I looked across his bed and I see his mother there, her eyes welling with tears. And we both realized that he would never walk again. And then she started to tell the story of what it would take to get him home, right? She said, we need a new ramp. We need an ambulance, like a van. We need a wheelchair. We need new outlets. And they're just a poor family from North Philly. And this idea of the great cost, obviously he lost his mobility. He lost, you know, a certain kind of future. But also there was this financial cost. And so I started to think about this idea of, you know, nobody cares about that young brother or young brothers like him. But maybe you care that every time a bullet hits flesh, we're all paying a price, right? Somehow, some way, in a literal dollar amount. And so I had this idea that I was calling million-dollar bullets. And so I had million-dollar bullets in my head, and I pitched it to newspaper. Everywhere I worked, I was trying to pitch this story, and I just couldn't get it done. Until many years later, in 2015, a book agent had approached me and said, listen, if there's ever anything you want to do, you know, come talk to me. And so I pitched the idea, and then it just made sense. The timing was right. It was right after Trayvon and Michael Brown. And so we were grappling with, how violence is heaped upon young Black men in particular. And there was all this gun violence and Freddie Gray, all this stuff was happening. And it just felt like it was the right time. Now, the book changed dramatically from what those earlier right. seeds. But that was the beginning.
I'm listening to it, to the way you describe it, and it kind of broke my heart. Like, literally, we're in this interview, and I'm, like, trying to piece my heart back together because You know, it is just so sad to me that we as journalists have to think about angles to make people have empathy for, in this case specifically, for young Black people. Like, we have to think of an angle and say to you, like, well, this bullet economically cost you money, and that's maybe right. you will care more about the economics of this bullet and want to stop this stuff, because clearly you don't care about the people that are being impacted.
That's right. This idea, and you and I both know this well, the gut-wrenching exercise of humanizing our people, finding ways where other people, white people, white society, might connect, might have some compassion for the violence that we experience every day, the literal violence, but also the systemic violence that keeps this whole thing together. It's a terrible dance we have to do, but we kind of have to do that because things are as they are, not as we want them to be.
Right, absolutely. I mean, that's the work. The work itself is what it is. And for people called to do it, that's just the burden you have to carry. But still, sometimes, like, you just pull back a little bit and it's like, wow, like, I have to make an economic case in order for this to matter to the general public, which is just wild to me. So you're putting this book together. It's your passion project, and you've been working hard on it. And right after you turned in your first draft, life took a turn that you just did not see.
At the age of 38, I had a heart attack 8 years ago, this past July. And it was one of those moments where, in the midst of it actually happening, I wasn't clear it was a heart attack, but I was clear my life felt like it was ending in that moment. For a few days, walking to the train, I live in New York, and I was walking to the train, and I feel a little pressure in my chest. And I thought it was one of those times where I was just a little more out of shape than normal. I'm a former athlete and I usually stay in shape, but it's one of those times where I've been, you know, out the gym for a while. And so I didn't think much of it. And then the day of the heart attack, earlier that day, I went to have coffee with a friend of mine at work. And I walked down the steps to meet her and I felt like I was going to pass out. And so I said, you know, I'm going to go to the clinic at 30 Rock at NBC just to get checked out. And so I go in there and they listen to my heart and they put a little EKG thing on me. And they said, you know what? The left side of your heart is a little enlarged. At some point, you should go see someone, right? A cardiologist. But it's not like you're going to go home tonight and drop dead. Verbatim.
Wow.
I'm not going to drop dead. Then later that night, I go home and my wife was cleaning the bedroom. And so I was on the sofa sleeping and she woke me up and I went to the bedroom and like 3 minutes after I laid down, this enormous pressure in my chest, the world was spinning, cold sweat, nausea. It felt like my entire body was breaking down. And in fact, what I was feeling was death. I had a blood clot in my left anterior descending artery that was starving my heart. And that moment changed the book, certainly, changed my life, but changed the way I viewed the violence that I had been writing about, right? Yeah. I've been writing about bullets, but this blood clot lodged in my heart, lodged in my artery, was just as violent.
Before we go to the book, can you just talk to me about the weight of the heart attack and how it played out, you know, with your family?
And I just
want to hear about like the personal journey through that, because, you know, so we're at that age, right, where the thing I was talking to a friend of mine recently, and I was like, you know, we're at that age where, you know, if you have kids, they're still needing your guidance. If you mm-hmm. have parents, they now need your guidance. Mm-hmm. Work is crazy. The economy is going nuts. You're feeling crunched. Yeah. And you're just trying to get through the best you can. And then something like this happens. And, you know, I'm sure it has to change your perspective about life.
You know, it sounds cliche to think that in that moment, I was thinking about everything that I would miss. Mm-hmm. My daughter, who was 6 years old at the time, was this beautiful little inquisitive girl who is like my buddy to this day. She's turning 13 this summer. And to think about, you know, not, man, just.
Yeah, man, take your time.
To think about not being able to walk her to school, the science project. She wants to be a journalist like us. So talking about the W's, the five W's, and having little conversations with her and seeing that she's beginning to piece an understanding together, and I would miss that. It just, you know, it brought me to my knees in so many ways, but it also, coming out of that, that I did survive, that I did live, it was an opportunity to live more fully and more honestly. And so in the beginning, it was like, you know what? Let me get physically right. Because it's going to take more than that to get me. Death's going to have to, like, hawk me down.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, bro, I've been through enough. I said, you know what? I'm getting on this bike. I started to meditate. I started to really be just mindful. But it also forced me to engage with, you know, a weight that I had not fully unpacked that I was carrying, because my six-year-old daughter was asking me tough questions, how, you know, and why. And with no family history, no high blood pressure, no high cholesterol, I had the misfortune of some soft plaque just breaking off and a clot filled this place. But there was another weight on my heart that I had never fully engaged with. As a journalist for, you know, my entire career, operating on the edge of death and survival, Black death and survival in particular, and a family history pocked with early death and violence, I had to engage with that in a way that I had never expected to fully. And so, you know, again, re-engaging with how I'm living, the idea of mortality also, though.
Yeah.
There was a moment was kind of freeing in a way that, though every night for years, I went to sleep not knowing if I would wake up. And that was scary a little bit, because it was like I started traveling again for work and I was like, I don't want to die in this hotel room.
Right.
Then or if my wife had to go to work, I don't want to die. My daughter comes in the room and finds me. That was one side. But the other side was this clarity that we know tomorrow's not promised, but it truly is not promised. So how are we going to live? I have not, after that wave of a few years, I can honestly say that I haven't experienced stress in the way I understood it before. I ain't worried about nothing now. I'm really and truly not. Like, what's, come on now. So I feel free in some ways where it's like, man, it's going to come at some point, hopefully far down the road. So I'm going to do everything I want to do. I'll be fishing every chance I get. I'm chilling. I'm going to Martha's Vineyard right now, right? For last year was my first year. I ain't grown up with nobody going to Martha's Vineyard. But give me the finger sandwiches. Yes.
Yeah.
How you pronounce this? How you pronounce this? Let me get some of that, please.
So
as scary as things have been, honestly, there is a freedom. And I think, you know, in the reshaping of my life and the reshaping of my understanding of life and death and the reshaping of the book, there is something, I think clarity is the word. There's a clarity now, man, with the story I was trying to tell in my life.
Coming up on More to the Story, Tremaine Lee talks about the revelation that helped him write his personal story.
It blew my mind and that, like, yo, what almost killed me was being Black in America. And that changed everything.
Before we get to that, let's get a little personal here. I mean, that is what this episode is all about. We've been bringing you More to the Story for 6 months now, and I just want to thank you for coming along on this ride with me and the team. We are building a community and we need to grow. So come on, invite your friends to take a listen. Give us a rating or a review on your favorite podcast app, because what we are building is powerful, and these type of conversations are needed now more than ever. Okay, more with Tremaine Lee coming up.
Hello, listener. My name is Najib Amini, and I am a producer here at Reveal. Reveal is a nonprofit news organization, and we depend on support from our listeners like you. Donate today at revealnews.org/donate. It helps fund the stories that we tell and helps me feed my cat. So thank you.
This is More to the Story. I'm Al Letson here with journalist Tremaine Lee.
A filmmaker
that I know has a movie, a series. It's a movie, but it's like 4 hours long. It's like it was on PBS. But the title of the movie, it was based off an African proverb that was, "You never know how alive you are until there's a lion in the room." And
that's right.
When I go through stuff recently, like one of my kids was really sick and it was really scary. And he was in the hospital for like almost 4 months. And that saying, like, I felt it so deep. I understood it before, but like when you are sitting in the room and you feel like death is on the other side, like, you know, there's a lion in this room and I gotta squeeze life and get everything I possibly can out of it, because we are not promised tomorrow. It is like you could walk outside now and it all be gone, or the people you love be gone. And what did you do in the meantime, you know?
Right. And so when we are not promised the nightfall, no. We are not promised that.
No. So one more question about the family stuff. Like, how did you explain this to your daughter? Because 6 is that age where they are beginning to understand life. But I don't know if they truly have an understanding of death at that part, right? Like, they understand life in the terms of, like, life is good. Like, mom and dad are here. We get to have fun. We do this. We do that. And they, a little bit of sense of self, maybe. But the idea that it could all go away is so foreign at that age.
Well, 2 things. I think, one, I don't think most adults understand mortality, because we don't live as if it's going to end, right? We don't. And even when you have a proximity or a proximal relationship to death, you've experienced it through people, and that's a certain kind of pain of that loss. It's hard for us to understand that we might not be here one day. I think it's harder to fully conceptualize. And before I get to my daughter, I want to say one thing that was a moment. So the whole time, I just want to backtrack a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, please.
So the heart attack happens, and for about 10 minutes, it feels like I'm separating from my physical form. This crazy, I can't even explain how it felt, but I'm separating myself. And then it passes. Then the ambulance comes, the EMTs, they take my vitals. They say, you know, everything looks pretty good to us. Do you want to go to the hospital? And I said, my daughter has camp in the morning. This is how men, this is how we.
Yeah.
I said, you know what? I said, my daughter has camp in the morning. My wife has a trip. I'll wait until the morning to get to the hospital. I don't want to inconvenience my family. I don't want, you've been in the hospital. I don't want to have my baby in the hospital and my wife. And so all night long, I'm tossing and turning on the sofa with a 98% blockage in the main artery giving my heart blood. The next day, we drop my daughter off at camp and I go into urgent care. I don't know why I'm going to urgent care, but I'm going doubled over across the street. Bro, I tell them what's going on. They said, yo, go to the emergency room now. Like, what are you doing here? Like, get there. So we get there and they're still like, you look so young. They're still not, they're not sure what's going on. After like 7 or 8 hours, they finally take a blood test and find troponin, which is a compound or protein that's released if you have heart damage. They said, we think you might have had a heart attack. We're going to prep you for the cath lab tomorrow. So mind you, I still haven't gotten the cath lab yet. So they're like, wow, tomorrow. And then fortunately, my cardiologist, who was my cardiologist today, said, you know what? Let's get you in there now. And so I'm on the table. There's a big screen over my shoulder and they're threading, you know, whatever it is through my wrist in the vein. And he's tooling around in there and he pulls it out. He said, you are a very lucky man. He said, you almost had a complete blockage. I put 2 stents in there to clear it. And he said, where is your wife? I was like, let's go talk to her. And in that moment, I started to smile because I was like, yo, your boy was almost out of here. Like, I was so happy because I had a heart attack. I survived it though, right?
Yeah.
So I'm actually feeling pretty good. Like, literally dodged one. But then the next day, and there's another one of those moments that I get choked up thinking about, it's my wife, my brother, my sister, my mother, and we're all in the room. And I made a joke to my wife. I said, man, you almost became a thousandaire. Like, you almost got, and then I was like, she almost had to collect death benefits for me. And I broke down sobbing like a baby in my mother's arms, because the reality was, again, all of that crashing down on you, like, how close of a call that really was. And then my family would have to collect benefits on me. So, I mean, I'm in the midst of all that. And I still have this precious, beautiful little girl, this little smart little girl who we had been watching. She had been watching me in Ferguson, Missouri. She had been watching me in Baltimore. So she's attuned, and we have real honest conversations, as honest as you can possibly be with a six-year-old. And I was trying to explain that, you know, what happened to daddy's artery is like a pipe, right, with some gunk, got stopped up, and it almost stopped my heart. And that wasn't good enough for her, because she was already starting to ask about God. She started asking about Jesus and religion a little bit. And I'm trying to be honest, like, baby, I don't know. Here's the story. Here's the thing. And we're tapping into something bigger than ourselves. And I'm trying to, you know, but with this, it really forced me to acknowledge what was bearing down in my heart. The stress of telling these stories of Black life and death and survival and the spectacle of death, but also a family history going back a very long time, to realize like what we've inherited, but we never fully process. As a young journalist running and gunning and hanging out and drinking, and when I was single, we're dating and we're moving around and we're hitting the deadlines, and then after that we're hanging out, it never fully engaging what it means to carry this specific kind of weight that Black people in this country have had to bear. The violence, certainly of the bullet, but the systemic violence that is necessary, that is a requisite for these ecosystems in which we experience that other violence to actually occur. And so it blew my mind in that, like, yo, what almost killed me was being Black in America. And that changed everything.
I think as we turn to talk a little bit more about the book, that being a Black journalist, especially in the time that you're talking about, or in the time of Ferguson, in the time of Trayvon Martin, that reporting on it carried a weight for Black journalists that I don't think we talk about enough, that I don't think, I don't even think we really acknowledge it. Because here's the thing about acknowledging that working in journalism is that as a Black journalist, this is just the truth. You have to be better. You can't talk about like you're having trauma about this or that or the other thing. You have to just do the job, because you talk about that type of stuff, you're not going to get work. You're not going to get the jobs. You're not going to be able to keep doing the reporting that you feel is important, because nobody does this type of reporting because they want to. We do it because we're called to do it, because we see, you know, Mike Brown, and we see ourselves, we see our cousins, we see our brothers, our sisters, all of that. Like when I see Breonna Taylor, like Breonna Taylor looks like she could belong in my family. So for me, it's like, I got to tell that story, because if I don't, who will? And so you're drawn to it, but you also experience the trauma of it in a way that you can't really, you can't talk about really, except with other Black journalists. And then we tend to not talk about it publicly because right. Again, we want to get the job.
I remember as a very young journalist, there was the Jason Blair case. Blair, young Black journalist from New York Times, who was perhaps one of the most fabulous plagiarists of all time. He was
talking
saying
about
he was in Oklahoma.
When,
he was like saying he was in Oklahoma and was in the sports department. Like, and it was just a mess. And there was this like ripple effect, I remember, a chilling effect of, you know, what it means to be Black now. Are they going to see us like that? And other people saying, you know, the kinds of jobs that we were taking, some people didn't want the so-called ghetto beat, which meant you were covering urban affairs and Black life in cities. But I think for some of us, that's the reason why we're doing this, is to not just shine light in dark spaces, to remind the world of who we are and tell our story, because no one loves us but us. And that's the bottom line. No one cares about us. We're still grappling with the Negro problem in this country. And so the weight that comes with of navigating these white newsrooms, it's like the plantation. And every day, we have to walk into the big house with our nice clothes paid for by the plantation and convince them that what's happening in the back corner of the plantation matters. That every day when it rains, people are getting sick because they're stuck in the mud. And every day, you can't get the kids to school because the schoolhouse, they got the hole in the roof because y'all haven't. And they're like, I know some black people back there. And I don't know if that's true. And then you got to go back to the plantation. And they like, man, you looking real clean. I see you in the big house. Look like you eating well. And you're like, yeah, my grandma and them from around here. Y'all know me. I'm trying to tell
right, you. Right, so right, this, right.
So right. This dynamic.
It is the, not just the dynamic of having to code switch and leave a part of you behind to go into this space and specifically be able to advocate for the stories that you're trying to tell outside the space. It's also coming to the space and them looking at you like, I don't know.
But I think it's like that is, and you're right, we haven't fully talked about it. And all of us who, as black journalists who tell these stories, who are mission driven, who are purpose driven, right? Who have our North Star is telling the whole truth about how we experience this country. There is also this assumption or this perceived bias because we understand the experience so well, there has to be a bias. We have to have some jaundiced vision because we see it too clearly. And so you have to be so good. Right. You have to be so sharp and you can't make any mistakes. Right. Because you will find yourself without a job. No, it's a lot, man. But especially then, because, there was this emotional heat of the moment, but there was also this fire. Right. So we're engaging with America tearing at its threads. Right. And what it means to value black life and people to say enough is enough. And how do we cover that through the mainstream lens has never been easy. And I'm not sure we figured out a way to do it except for to go out there time and again and tell the truth.
I'm not saying goodbye to Tremaine because part two of our conversation is coming up next week. We'll talk about coming to grips with the systemic pain that violence has wreaked on our lives.
Confronting the violence, the silent, quiet violence from within. And as men in particular, but in general, finding the strength and courage to face that down and live freely and live happily and find peace. That's why this matters, because it hurts so bad.
More with journalist Tremaine Lee next week. And just a reminder, we are listener supported, and that means listeners like you. You can help us thrive by making a gift today. Just go to revealednews.org/gift. Again, that's revealednews.org/gift. And thank you. This episode was produced by Josh Sanborn and Cara McGurk Allison. Brett Myers edited the show. Theme music and engineering help by Fernando, my man, Yo Aruda, and Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs. I'm Al Letson, and come on, let's do this again next week. I'll see you here. This is More to the Story.
From PRX.